It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seewert. Pedestrian deaths increased by 50% last year. It's a trend we're seeing in states throughout the country. That's according to a new report from the Governor's Highway Safety Association. But the big question is why and what can be done to change course. Call in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Angie Schmidt is the author of Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. It was published in 2020 by Island Press. Angie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So according to the Governor's Highway Safety Association, pedestrian deaths have jumped 77% in the past decade. Does that number surprise you?
A little bit, yes. My book was published about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. and at that time they were up about 50%. So yes, the dramatic increase just over the last few years actually does surprise me a little bit.
I mean, do you usually see things getting safer instead of less safe? What about that?
Yes, we do. That's the thing. In traffic safety, the pattern since the 1970s, since we started requiring seatbelts and airbags, has been that outcomes gradually get better. We're supposed to be getting better at this. So this is very unusual to have this sustained increase.
Wisconsin is one of 24 states where pedestrian deaths are growing. Here we saw a 28% increase in pedestrian deaths for the first half of 2021 to 2022. What factors are behind all this? How did we get here?
Sure. Yeah. So the long-term rise, what I explain in my book, there's a number of sort of social trends happening at the same time that are all bad news on this issue. So one of them is that the population is aging a little bit, so we're a little more vulnerable. We also have more lower-income folks living in the suburbs and living in the Sun Belt, and both of those areas are more dangerous places to walk than some of our older cities that were built before sort of the auto era in the United States. And then thirdly, and most importantly, we're driving bigger cars than we did in the past. We have a lot more SUVs. Our pickup trucks are much, much bigger than they were in the 90s or even a decade ago. So people are being hit with heavier vehicles, higher on their bodies, where they're more likely to be sort of pushed under the car and run over.
You mentioned cities that are more dangerous places to walk. What do you mean?
So the most dangerous places to walk in the United States are typically Sunbelt cities. And those are cities that sort of didn't grow until after the invention of air conditioning. And they were built at the height of the auto era, sort of around the time we're building the interstate highway system in the United States. So a lot of their streets are really wide and a lot of their land use patterns are really sprawling. And it's led to really dangerous conditions for walking in those cities.
We're talking about the spike in pedestrian deaths over the past decade. With us is Angie Schmidt, the author of Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Fascinating book. So these pedestrian deaths are happening everywhere, but it seems like these certain areas are more prone. What about rural areas? Are we seeing it there too?
That's a good question. I'm not sure what the latest data says about that. One thing that we do know is that pedestrians in cities, a lot of times, either close to half or even in some cases, a majority of the traffic deaths will be pedestrian deaths. Rural areas can be very dangerous areas as far as traffic safety. A lot of people, rural people, do get killed in car crashes, but they're a little bit more likely to be driving. But some of the conditions that do make it dangerous for pedestrians are definitely present in rural areas, like lack of sidewalks, lack of street lighting. It's just that fewer people usually are walking in rural areas.
How does vehicle speed factor into whether a pedestrian will be killed in this kind of issue?
Speed is the most important factor. So a pedestrian who is struck at 40 miles per hour is more likely than not to be killed. But if they're struck at 20 miles per hour, they almost always survive. So controlling speeds, even controlling for a few miles per hour slower, some data shows that for every mile per hour reduced, there's about a 6% reduction in the fatality rate.
So what other factors are common in pedestrian fatalities? Night versus day, people in crosswalks. What are we talking about here?
Right, yes. So night is a huge factor. About 3 in 4 pedestrian deaths happen at night. There's also certain groups that are more vulnerable. One thing I talk about in my book is that this issue is a little like we're discovering with a lot of public health problems, where some of the issues with inequality and racism in our society sort of come through in the data. So, Black people and Native people are much more likely to be killed than white or Asian people, but also other demographic groups. Older people are more likely to be killed while walking, people who live in lower income neighborhoods. And there's also some evidence that other groups, like people with disabilities or homeless people, are at increased risk.
Why is that? Just because they're less able to take, a car somewhere, or I mean, what plays into that?
Yeah, I think yes, that is part of it, that lower income people, for example, would be more likely to rely on the bus, right? Especially in areas that are a little bit hostile to pedestrians. But also, we haven't been doing a good job designing the system for those kind of folks. We've really catered to like who we think of as a typical person. And that might be, a middle-aged man who drives his car to work on the highways. We've really catered to that kind of person. And people who don't really fit into that mold quite are a little bit, their needs are a little bit neglected. So someone who's like a new immigrant, who may be elderly, or someone who's retired, again, someone who has a mobility disability, those people often aren't getting the things they need from the system, like simple accommodations like curb ramps or bus stops that are well lighted and placed near a safe crossing.
Kenneth from Beloit called with a question. Kenneth wonders if Wisconsin is unique in having a law that requires cars to stop for pedestrians. Do you know?
You know what? That's a good question. The laws do vary state to state. And I don't know Wisconsin's law very well, but it could be that it has stronger protections for pedestrians than other states. And I would think that's a good thing. There are some states where even if a pedestrian is in a crosswalk, there are certain exclusions where a driver can get away with not yielding. And that's almost never enforced, by the way.
Yeah, it's funny because Kenneth talks about the law, and I live in Wausau, and I mean people just don't stop for people in the cross. I mean, if you're in the crosswalk, you're gonna get honked at or something. But yet you go to other communities like Minocqua, they always stop, and yeah, it does vary from state to state. It's really interesting there. I don't know. I mean, do you think that that kind of law could, if those were enforced on a more aggressive level, that it would have an impact?
So you're right that, well, there's a lot of studies that show, including I worked with a researcher out of Wisconsin on my book, that show that drivers are really terrible at yielding to pedestrians. I don't even think some drivers understand that if they have a green light and they're turning, they do need to watch for and yield to pedestrians at crosswalks in a lot of locations. So like I said, it's almost never enforced. And I do think we could do a better job, definitely. I don't know. And occasionally in some places around the country, they will do these kind of stings where they have an undercover officer crossing, and usually they're issuing a warning the first time, but there really is a lack of awareness, and in our culture, a lot of hostility to pedestrians.
There sure is. I mean, I can tell you that for sure. Angie Schmidt is a writer and expert on sustainable transportation. She's the author of Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Call 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue our discussion on pedestrian safety in light of a report that found pedestrian deaths are increasing nationwide up to 50% in Wisconsin from 2021 to 2022. How is this problem solved? Call 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Angie Schmidt is the author of Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Your book, Right of Way, looks at the role that race and class play in pedestrian deaths. We touched on this a little bit already, but I want to ask you to expand on that a little bit. Why is this such an issue that involves both race and class?
Yeah, well, it has to do, it has to do with who's sort of being forced to rely on an inadequate sort of safety environment, right? So I think a lot of people who are a little more privileged, a little more well off, they're just not put in the position of having to cross sort of a 7-lane high speed road to get to a bus that only comes once every hour, right? And I think if more wealthy people sort of were put in that position, we wouldn't stand for it. So we see there's studies that have shown, you know, there's less safety infrastructure in low-income neighborhoods, neighborhoods of color, and those are really the neighborhoods that need it most. So even communities that have focused a lot on trying to improve safety for people who walk and bike, if it's not targeted to the neighborhoods that need it most, really isn't going to help resolve the issue.
Jill from Oconomowoc called. She noticed that many cars don't actually stop at crosswalks and intersections. They just pull right into them. So if they're stopping at a stoplight, they're pulling right into them. And she feels like it seems like a recent development. I mean, do you feel like this puts pedestrians more at risk? And what can, well, I mean, it does, right? Because they're in the crosswalk. But what do you think can be done about that?
Right, I agree. There's a lot of agreement that that problems with reckless driving and aggressive driving and speeding got worse during the pandemic, and that has contributed to a rise in traffic deaths. So one thing that seems to be going on is there's less enforcement after 2020 and the George Floyd protests, obviously bringing to light a lot of the problems with the way we've done traffic enforcement. But also it seems to be just kind of a consequence of some sort of fraying of our social fabric, sort of our norms around how we're supposed to behave as a society have eroded a little bit. And I think it goes back before this. I don't think our norms were very pro-social or healthy around the way we treated pedestrians before this. But unfortunately, it seems to have gotten worse. And there's a lot of influences in our culture. Like you think of these movies that are marketed to young men that are all about car racing and everything. There's sort of a condoning of some behavior that's really dangerous and has some really awful consequences for ordinary people, because about 40,000 people every year are killed in car crashes now. And now we're up to almost 8,000 pedestrian deaths a year. And that's to say nothing of the injuries that really change people's lives and cause a lot of additional harm.
We're talking about pedestrian safety with Angie Schmidt, a safety expert. She owns the Cleveland-based consulting firm 3MPH. I have to point out that pedestrian and bicyclist deaths have been declining in Europe for years. So how is street safety different between Europe and the United States? What are we doing differently here?
Yeah, they're doing a lot of things better. And in fact, it's in a lot of cases, obviously, they have a built environment that's a little more pedestrian friendly. Some of the cities in Europe, you know, are these kind of ancient cities that were never divided by freeway interchanges and that kind of thing. So they do have some advantages there, but also their policies are a little bit stronger. Like the United States, the World Health Organization has 5 recommendations on traffic safety, and the United States is in compliance with none of them. And in addition, we have been doing a bad job regulating our vehicles. So we have NHTSA in the United States, which regulates vehicles. There's pages and pages of rules for things about the way a bumper is shaped and how, you know, how airbags are sort of structured. But we've never regulated cars for pedestrian safety. That is supposed to change now as a result of the infrastructure bill. But even now with this big run-up, NHTSA has sort of been trying to avoid rating vehicles for pedestrian safety. So that 5-star vehicle rating system, we still allow cars, very dangerous cars for pedestrians that we know are much more likely to kill people on foot or bike. We still allow those cars to have 5-star vehicle safety rating systems. So we're not even informing the buyers that there's these additional risks.
In Europe, do they tell people, is that part of their process?
Yes, in Europe and Japan is another leader. So in Europe, one of the things they're doing across the European Union now, which is really interesting and could have a big impact, is they have something called intelligent speed assistance. So that means the car basically cannot speed. There, it's programmed that there's GPS, they know the speed limit, and it is just required to comply with the speed limit. So that technology is available on the shelf, and we just have not used it in the United States. We have about 10,000 pedestrian, or we have about 10,000 speeding deaths a year in the United States, and we're not using the available technology that could keep people safe. So in addition, in Japan and Europe, they have modified car designs to help protect pedestrians. For example, there are certain things that can be done to the hood, little airbags that sort of inflate, or more softer hoods and bumpers that can save pedestrians' lives. And again, we've never done that in the United States.
Wow. I mean, yeah, those things are things that I've never even heard that those things are, are even available. What about the size of SUVs? We have big SUVs and trucks, and they're bigger than what you see the SUVs in Europe.
Absolutely. That's a huge, huge factor. In my book, I say it's really the factor in this increase that we can point to most clearly. And it's gotten a lot worse in recent years. Some of the best-selling pickup trucks in the United States, like the Ford F-150, Ford F-250, this Chevy Silverado now, those are in the top three vehicles sold in the United States every year. They now have hoods that are 55 inches tall, which, to put in perspective, I'm about a tall to normal size woman. That would come up to about my chin. So not only is it going to hit me sort of in my chest and abdomen, with a lot of force. Also, there's some visibility concerns now with a lot of these large vehicles. There's this group called kidsandcars.org, and they did experiments and they found they could see like more than a dozen children in the front blind zone of some of the best-selling vehicles in the United States. So that's contributing as well. There's been sort of an arms race towards bigger and bigger vehicles on the part of especially American automakers.
What about street design? I mean, can local governments, state governments, work to decrease the number of pedestrian deaths immediately by changing street design?
Yes, there's a lot we can do to encourage safer driving with the way we design streets. So planners, that's I come from an urban planning background, engineers, there's all these different tricks. They may use speed humps, or you can narrow intersections so the, and change the curb radius so that it forces drivers to take turns a little bit slower. There's high visibility crosswalks. There's a lot we can do with street design. And actually, I think you do have a success story in Wisconsin with Madison. I believe Madison is one city that has invested a lot and is kind of bucking the trend here, and it's actually seen traffic deaths overall decrease substantially in the context of them rising across the country quite a bit.
We talked a little bit about Europe, and they really got serious about preventing pedestrian deaths about in the 90s. Do you really think it's going to happen here? Do you think we're going to get into this, where we've got policy, we've got changes on the horizon?
Well, I am hopeful. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I think it hasn't been thought of as an issue. The traffic deaths are just sort of this background noise of our lives. And people don't realize that this is a solvable problem. There's people like in Washington that are making decisions that are life and death for other people. Like, for example, NHTSA just punted on some reforms for trucking companies that, again, could save dozens of lives a year. There is some positive movement. Yes, there are things that I'm excited about. Like I said, in the infrastructure bill called for some reforms. I'm a little unhappy with the way NHTSA has proceeded on that. But there's also been a lot of changes in the engineering, in the traffic engineering sort of mentality. Traffic engineers have really sort of changed their attitude about this. 10 years ago, it was all about vehicle throughput and capacity. And now there really is a lot more understanding of sort of the safety weaknesses that are built into the system. So I think there really are opportunities, and it is something we could address with the right level of commitment.
Angie, I want to thank you for being here today and sharing this information with us. It's a lot to think about.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Angie Schmidt is a writer. She is an expert on sustainable transportation and the author of Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. It was first published in 2020 by Island Press. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about an app that helps users practice the Hmong language.
In the late 2000s, Apple popularized the phrase, "There's an app for that," highlighting the abundance of apps available for the iPhone. But when Annie Vang of Madison got into app development around the same time, she didn't see programs made in the Hmong language. Producer Hope Kerwin has more on the app she built and the way it's keeping native speakers and beginners connected to the language.
Eau Claire resident Tiffany Moa grew up speaking Hmong with her family, but as she got older, she started to lose some of her vocabulary and found herself struggling to remember words she didn't use frequently.
You know, you go to school, you speak English only. I didn't have any classes where they taught you in Hmong, so my Hmong language wasn't utilized as much as I had wanted to.
Moa was scrolling through Facebook one day when she saw a post about an iPhone app called Hmong Phrases. The app allows users to look up words and common phrases and hear an audio recording of how they're pronounced. Moa says she immediately downloaded it, hoping to test out her memory and her grammar.
When you grow up and you don't really speak fluent Hmong, you kind of create your own little sentences and you just formulate your own way of saying things, and it's not always correct. One that I do remember looking for was, "Can I pay for this?" Even now, like if I were to go shopping at like an Oriental store, I wouldn't know how to formulate this sentence properly.
The Hmong Phrases app was created by fellow Wisconsinite Annie Vang, who it turns out is also Moa's aunt. Vang is an iOS app developer from Madison, and she built the program 11 years ago after taking an app development course at Madison Area Technical College. Vang says she was inspired by advice from her professor, who encouraged her to build something she was passionate about.
Google Translate didn't exist at that time. And the Hmong language definitely was not in Rosetta Stone or any of the other language apps that were out there in the App Store. And so I took it upon myself that, you know, I want people to know who we are, who I am. And I felt that it was important to just, you know, have a presence in the App Store and leave a digital footprint of it.
11 years, constant updates, and one major rewrite later, the app now has over 4,000 downloads. Vang says she's always looking for ways to improve the program, taking feedback directly from users and from her parents, who are her primary beta testers. She says there have been some surprising requests from users about what they'd like to see added. She's been asked for more medical terms and Hmong names from people hoping to use them for babies.
They're interested in, like, how do you say a baby name? What does it mean? How do you pronounce it? And I thought it was kind of cool. So that's a feature that I'm currently building it right now, because we're such an oral language that if you just read the word, the name, you may not know how to pronounce it.
Beyond learning words and phrases, Vang says the app also allows native Hmong speakers to practice their intonation, an important part of the mostly oral language. She says young Hmong Americans often speak Hmong stiffly or struggle to hit the right tonal marks.
I can hear that a lot in like the kids that are growing up that are not speaking it like fluently with maybe an elder. Even my nieces and nephews do the same thing, where when they say they're hungry, they're saying it like it doesn't have the right tone markers. And so you can understand what they're saying, but they may not know that they're saying it more English than Hmong.
This is something that niece and app user Moa says she appreciates about the program. Growing up, Moa says she spoke both English and Hmong to her parents, or sometimes a combination of the two, which she and other speakers call Hmonglish.
My parents knew enough of what I was trying to say that in the spot, because they understood it, they didn't say, oh no, you're saying that wrong. They'll just answer you.
Moa says she's not sure she'll ever fully master the Hmong language, but she's motivated to keep practicing so she can one day pass it on to her children and maintain the connection to her native language.
WPR's Hope Kerwin brought us that story about an app for the Hmong language. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. Buying a new or used car is a challenging experience, even the best of times. But with higher prices and soaring interest rates, it's an especially difficult experience right now. Are you in the market for a car, having trouble finding one at an affordable price? You can call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ronald Montoya is a senior consumer advice editor for Edmunds.com. That is a popular car shopping website. Ronald, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Cars.com says in late 2022, the average interest rate for a new vehicle loan was just over 6%. And the average used vehicle loan interest rate was more than 10%. So how can a consumer find the best deal on an auto loan?
Yeah, if you look at automakers, their finance arms, they're going to offer the best rates. You typically have to have solid to good credit in order to qualify, but that is a way to get some of the better rates. Also, you can check in with dealerships who have partnerships with a number of banks, and they can give you more of a chance of qualifying for a better loan. But you have to know what the averages are, and that helps you set like a baseline for what you need to pay.
What about people who have less than stellar credit, people who have some credit challenges?
Yeah, if you have a less than stellar credit, you're going to have to probably put more money down so that you're financing less. And keep in mind that used cars tend to have a higher interest rate. So that's just something to keep in mind. And you can always, you know, reduce the amount of vehicle purchase that you're going to do. So just find something less expensive, and that's something that's going to help you get a better rate.
Are buyers able to negotiate with lenders on a loan rate, or is it pretty much, I don't know, I mean, set in stone?
It depends. If it's like a pre-set rate, you can negotiate, but it's not going to be very much. I would say you're better off getting quotes from multiple banks so that you could see what the range is there.
Do you feel like it's better to just go straight to a dealer and talk to them about their lending or do that shopping yourself?
I would say get pre-approved from a bank or credit union beforehand. This lets you know what you can afford, what the baseline would be for an interest rate, and then you can go to the dealership and see how that differs from what you got.
We're talking about how to get the best auto loan rate for your next vehicle purchase with Ronald Montoya, a senior consumer advice editor for Edmunds.com. Ron, consumer credit reporting company Experian says the average time to pay off a new car loan is almost 6 years now. And I mean, I feel like that's longer than it used to be. Is that the case, or am I just imagining things?
Yeah, it's been steadily rising over the years. We've seen it as high as 70 months. And that just means that a lot more people are taking on 72-month loans. Used to be 60 months was the norm, but we're far from that now.
How long should a loan term be? Is longer better or worse when it comes to buying a car?
Longer is worse because you're going to pay more interest over the course of the loan. I would say realistically, if you can do 60 months, that's kind of an ideal one. But if you can handle a lower loan term, that's better.
Do you find, I mean, obviously you want to pay less interest, so a shorter loan rate is better from that regard. But do you risk with a longer loan, do you risk being upside down in the loan? Like, I mean, how frequently does that happen where all of a sudden you owe way more than the car is worth and you want to trade it in?
Yeah, that tends to happen almost immediately, especially if you haven't put a significant down payment. And this kind of reduces your flexibility if you want to get rid of the car later, or if it gets totaled in an accident, and the insurance company is only going to pay you what the car is worth, not what you owe on the loan.
If you are shopping for a car, you have car buying questions, there's lots of time yet to call 800-642-1234. You can also email us ideas@wpr.org and we'll ask that question for you. What do you think about how buyers determine what their monthly car loan rate should be? I mean, or how much they should pay? How much can a person afford? Is there a formula or like a hard, fast rule of X amount of percent of your income should go toward a car payment?
Yeah, there's like a rough rule that we have that's about 15% of your take-home pay is what your monthly payment should be. And we keep in mind gas and insurance in that because sometimes people don't factor that in and that could bump it up a couple hundred.
Okay. And do lenders keep, is that kind of the rule for lenders as well, or does that really vary?
That's going to vary. They have their own formulations with how they approve people for a loan. So that's just something you'll have to check with them.
Given new car interest rates of greater than 6% for new cars, more than 10% for used ones, when would it be better to repair an older vehicle rather than buy one? What factors go into that decision?
In most cases, it's going to be less expensive over the course of a few years to keep your car and keep it running. But you have to see if you feel comfortable with making the repairs and if you feel safe with the car. And ultimately, if you're not paying significantly more than the car is worth in repairs, that's when you might want to consider a new car.
So, I mean, what would you recommend for a car owner that's thinking, boy, I don't know. I mean, is this going to be worth it to keep fixing it? What should a person do to research how reliable their vehicle might be? I keep hearing my dad's voice in my head going, this car is nickel and diming me to death. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, there's not a set formula. Every car is going to be different, especially in how people have taken care of it over the years. But in general, if you're starting to see a lot of repairs coming up frequently, then that's something. But even if you have a high ticket item, let's say it's like $2,000 for a repair, that's going to be far less than it costs for a new car. So that's just something to keep in mind. Plus, you're going to have monthly payments on top of that on the new car.
Ronald Montoya is a senior consumer advice editor for Edmunds.com. He stays with us. You can call 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seewert. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Show. I'm Shereen Seewert. We continue our discussion on buying and financing both new and used vehicles in a challenging economy. You can call in with your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Ronald Montoya is a senior consumer advice editor for Edmunds.com. He stays with us. Ron, how did we get here it feels like cars are so expensive now compared to a few years ago?
Yeah, there's been a shortage of vehicles due to a shortage in chips and supply chain issues. And so that has driven the price up over the years. And on top of that, people are preferring SUVs and trucks, which tend to cost more. And so all this has kind of led to the price of a vehicle gradually going up over the years.
Is it a financial, I don't know. I mean, if you're considering buying new versus used, what is more financially responsible to do?
If you can find an inexpensive used car and you have a solid interest rate, so I would say less than the average, that's probably the best financial move you can do. And, you know, you want to keep that car a few years. But if you feel more comfortable buying a new car, then just make sure that you get a good interest rate there as well and keep it multiple years past when it's paid off, because a lot of people, especially with these longer loans, they tend to get tired of the car after the loan is paid off and they're not reaping any of the benefits from having a paid off car.
What about leasing versus financing? What are your thoughts on that?
So leasing will be more expensive in the long run, but if you're just thinking about your budget and you can only afford X amount per month, it is going to be lower. And if you like the ability to switch cars every few years, then leasing is a good move as well. And also, if you're looking into electric vehicles, we like to recommend leasing because the technology changes so often that by the time your lease is up, there could be better options for you.
A few select electric vehicles like the Chevy Bolt, the Ford F-150 Lightning qualify for a pretty significant federal tax credit. How do tax credits affect the financial calculation of buying a new electric vehicle?
It definitely helps, but I always like to point out that this is not a flat rebate on the car. This is a tax credit. So you need to have a tax responsibility of up to $7,500. And if you don't, if you come up a little bit short, it's non-refundable. So you're not going to get that difference. So just keep that in mind. And eventually it will help you on your taxes, but it's not going to be a straight discount on the car.
Last year, Consumer Reports said electric vehicles were among the least reliable cars and trucks in the automotive industry. Is that still true? What do you think people should know about the reliability of electric vehicles?
I think the software is typically the issue there. I don't think the car is going to leave you stranded. So when we talk about reliability, it's not from that perspective. But it is new technology, and a lot of the vehicle relies on software. And so sometimes that can have its own bugs. But I think one of the cool things about electric cars is that they're able to be fixed with over-the-air updates. But I wouldn't let that deter me from buying an electric car.
We're talking about the current new and used car market with Ronald Montoya, a senior consumer advice editor for Edmunds.com. Can you still go into a dealership and try to bargain with them? Or is that less common now?
You could absolutely try to, but just know that the discount is going to be far less than in previous years. In the month of May, we have seen a discount of about $616 on average. And you compare that to a few years ago, it was like thousands off. So if you keep that in mind, know that the margins are going to be smaller, you can negotiate. And also, certain brands tend to have more discounts than others in the current market. So if you look at brands like Honda, Toyota, Dodge, Cadillac, those are brands that typically don't have as much discounts. So that's something to keep in mind. And if you look at brands like Lincoln, Buick, GMC, these are brands that are going to see higher discounts.
Why is that?
It's just because of the popularity of the vehicles, and perhaps it could be their inventory as well. They have more vehicles, so they need to discount them to make it more palatable for people.
I do feel like a couple of years ago, we were seeing, before the pandemic, really, we were seeing lots of commercials about, you know, trade it in and you can get another $4,000 off. And now you never see that anymore. What about trade-in prices? How are those these days?
Yes, that is one of the bright spots, is that trade-in prices are fairly high right now. And so you're able to help, that can help you get a better lower financed amount for your loan. And so if you use that, you can know that it will be helpful to you, and just get multiple quotes on the trade-in value so that you have more options and really know what the car is worth.
If I'm looking for a used car, should I wait? I mean, do you think that prices are going to go down in the used car sector anytime soon, or is this going to be the new norm?
For used cars, we're forecasting that they're going to stay about the same. There's not going to be too much changes. And that's just because there's a shortage of used cars. Typically, a big source of used cars are rental companies that they're trading in their cars after a few years. But they're hanging on to them, and that's not getting as much vehicles into the market. And so that's just keeping prices high right now.
Why are they hanging on to rental cars, hanging on to their cars longer, or are they just buying differently?
They're buying differently, and also there's less vehicles out there, so the prices are higher.
Okay. I guess I'm wondering about buying from a private party. How risky is it to buy a used car just from somebody that you find on a social media marketplace or in a classified ad?
Yeah, that can be risky. But it is a place to potentially get a better deal on a car than a traditional dealership. I would say you have to go with your gut instinct. talk to the person, see if you feel comfortable, see if you know why they're selling the car. And if you feel comfortable with that, you can move forward with it. You can also get a vehicle history report to give you a background on the car. And, you know, if you see them kind of dodging questions and not really being upfront with you, then perhaps that's a red flag for you.
Well, when do you think that new car prices will decline, or won't they? I mean, we've seen just a very small downturn in the price, but I mean, do you think that this whole market is going to change anytime soon?
So car prices are going down, but it's happening in very small increments, but we are seeing month-to-month changes. It's just happening very slowly. And one of the things to kind of emerge in this new market is that dealerships and the automakers are managing with fewer vehicles. They don't want to have that excess inventory as they did before. And so that's kind of keeping prices tight right now.
Do you think, given the high interest rates that we're seeing right now, that consumers might be better off waiting a little bit for those interest rates to fall? Or do you think that's not going to happen anytime soon? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's going to depend on the state of the economy. But in general, interest rates eventually fall. My understanding is that there's not going to be further rate hikes. You know, things can change over the years. But I would say if you wait it out a bit, it might be a better situation.
What do you think about online car shopping? My son bought a car. He was living in Utah, and he ended up buying a car from, like, you know, Carvana or something like that without even seeing it. What are your thoughts on that?
That's definitely a way that people are doing it these days. Just make sure that you have enough information on the car to make the purchase and take a look at their return policy and if you have to put any deposits down. But generally, I would say you want to take a look at the car and you want to test drive it for yourself. But if you find a good deal out there, then that's definitely something to consider.
Okay. How popular are those online car buying services?
I don't have exact numbers for those, but I know that on Edmunds, we do list used vehicle inventory and new. So that's an option for you. You do still have to go to the dealership, but you can see a lot of the vehicle prices online, and we give you an idea of whether it's a good deal or not.
Ron, I want to thank you for spending the time today. I appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Ronald Montoya, a senior consumer advice editor for Edmunds.com. I'm Shereen Seewert. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.